This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Hello, it's the Nerdist Podcast number 508. I'm in Anaheim right now because today is Friday, the 18th of April, and it's WonderCon weekend. The 19th and 20th are also WonderCon days here in Anaheim, California. I enjoy WonderCon. I've been going to WonderCon since it was in Northern California and then moved down here to Southern California a couple of years ago. It's a good convention. It hasn't been touched too much by a lot of big film and television companies yet, so the floor is, it really is just the vendors. It's just vendors selling their wares, and it's a nice community. I enjoy it. We're doing our Nerdist panel Sunday at noon in the arena, and then I'm doing a signing at the Nerdist booth from 2 to 3. Yes, we have a booth. We have a snazzy booth. Come by and say hi. If I'm not there, you can molest the Lego version of me, which is sitting on a couch, and a good time will be had, hopefully by all. At least by most. If you can get most, you're in good shape. All is a great goal to have. But you don't know. You don't know what the different dynamics of a group are. Maybe one person is hungry or one person has to go to the bathroom. That's why you gotta take your whatever sort of rubber katana or...
Where are you going with this?
What?
I don't even know how you got here.
What are you even talking about anymore? I was just telling people how to deal with someone in their group who was dragging the group down because they weren't having a good time.
At a convention?
Yeah.
Take their badge and kick them out.
Well, the cold hand of justice. Thy name is Skydart. I would like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, Carbonite.com. Carbonite is online backup for all your files. Backs up in the background on your computer desktop, and you don't even know what's happening, but it gets done. And then all your stuff is backed up, and then when tragedy strikes, you can access all your files wherever you go. And you can do that with the Carbonite app, or you can do it on your computer. Start your free trial at Carbonite.com today. There's no credit card required. It is a free trial. Use the offer code Nerdist. You're going to get 2 free bonus months if you decide to buy. That's Carbonite.com. The offer code for 2 free bonus months is Nerdist. This episode is Brian Henson. Brian Henson, who the very first Nerdist offices were at the Henson lot. I've known Brian for a few years now. I love the Henson family, and it is... although there were stories that Brian tells in this podcast that I had not heard before about Jim. They're promoting Jim Henson's Creature Shop Challenge on the Sci-Fi Channel. It's Tuesdays at 10 p.m., but it was a good... I gotta say, these podcasts... I know I should probably just go have conversations with people in life, but for some reason, it's just become a really good excuse. I mean, if you enjoy listening to these, that is a nice bonus, using the offer code Nerdist. But for me, it's actually been a really fantastic way to catch up with people that I normally... I don't know why. Our schedules just get busy, and it's, you know, we're always in work mode, and having a work reason to catch up on a personal level is... seems like a nice excuse to get together. So here we go. This is the Nerdist Podcast number 508 with Brian Henson.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Dog with the finger in the mouth, and then so she's in Boston right now, so she sent me the same picture. I mean, almost identical.
The dog's amazing.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah! It's a damn, sweet. It's a damn cool dog.
Wow, we met him out her outside.
Yes, it's been fun and challenging because are we recording now, Katie? Good. It's been fun and challenging because I've never had a girl dog before, and with a girl dog, there is no warning when pee is going to fly out of her body. With a boy dog, they sort of sniff and then like a leg starts to go up and you go ah, and then you can scoop them up. But with Laika, it's just she's sitting there and all of a sudden it's just like the bomb hatch opens and woof, it just shoots out. You're like, how did that? It's like a magic trick. It's a magic trick. So it's been a little more challenging training her, but she is adorable. Do you have dogs?
I have two, yes.
You have two dogs?
Yeah. I have a Jindo that I got from a shelter like you did.
Yep.
And when I got her, they said it's a mixed shepherd. And then I got it home and I brought it to the vet, and the vet said, no, this isn't a mixed shepherd, it's a Korean Jindo.
Oh, wow.
Which is very different, yeah.
That's cool.
They're very territorial. Lovely dog, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So she's protective really of you and the family.
Yeah, she's a great guard dog, but really good with people. I cannot bring another dog into the house, though. Except I did get... Then I got a second dog, but that one I actually bought as a newborn, so I knew what it was. And it's half Cocker Spaniel, half Golden Retriever.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. And so did the other dog. Was the other dog
what's
like?
Up with it? Well, actually, the reason why I didn't get another dog from a shelter was I went to find what breed is the most passive. Because everybody said with a Jindo, they said you better find the most passive dog you can find. So he's really, really passive.
So you handpicked that dog to make sure that the Jindo wouldn't be like, this is not happening in my house. Not cool. We essentially have been neighbors twice. We were residential neighbors, and then we were work neighbors because Nerdist's first offices were at the Henson lot.
That's right.
Which is such an amazing historical piece of that lot. You're living on a museum, basically.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. No, we were an interesting story. We suddenly had to move out of the property we were in, the company, in 1991, and it was because we filed a suit against Disney. Yeah. After my dad died, he was going to sell the company to Disney. Then we couldn't complete the deal. Disney and Henson decided we can't complete this deal, so we scuttled the deal and weren't going to sell the Jim Henson Company to Disney anyway. They wanted to keep all the theme park attractions, but they wouldn't negotiate. And it was so we filed a suit, and then at 6 o'clock in the morning, our lawyers in New York filed the suit and called and said, somebody just called me literally at 6:30 in the morning and said, somebody just told me you're in Disney owned offices and you don't pay rent. And I said, well, yeah, because we were, you know, we were in these merger discussions and, you know, everybody's been, but yeah, that's true. And they said, well, then they own all of your files.
You have to leave.
You have to get everything out of there before they lock the doors. I thought, oh no. So we had to move out. So we moved our offices in about 2 hours at 6 o'clock in the morning, 6 to 8 o'clock in the morning. And we were in Rally Studios. And I didn't like it very much for the company. It wasn't really, the type of space wasn't really right for the Jim Henson Company. But we moved in thinking, well, we'll be here like 4 weeks while we find a good place. And we looked for a space that was right, that felt like a good fit for the Jim Henson Company. And it was 8 years. It took us 8 years to find that lot. But when the Charlie Chaplin studio, when that came on the market, basically we had a real estate agent who was looking for us to find a space that we would like. And he called us and said, it's just come on the market. So we went and got it very quickly. So, but it is wonderful, and it's fitting because it's Charlie Chaplin's studio. He built it with his brother. It's the first studio he built, and it's there on La Brea and Sunset, and now over the gate is there's a big Kermit the Frog who's dressed like Charlie Chaplin. So now it's the Henson's it's the Henson studio, but we celebrate the Chaplin history.
But it always looks like he's tipping his hat to the strip club across the street.
Well, he probably is. You know, I don't think we ever thought of that. You know, I have a strip club. I have a strip club next to my house, my apartment in New York City as well. And my daughter said to me, "Daddy, what is it with you and strip clubs?"
It's like they
there's
just keep,
always a strip club
it's
next
not
door.
Me. They just keep popping up there. I don't have anything to. I never really explored all of the recesses of that lot, but it's incredible to me that you could just walk into an office and like, oh, there's a Skeksis just right there, and just it's right there, like not even. I would think, why is that not behind bulletproof glass? Why are there not armed guards? They're just these original creations and puppets just out amongst human beings who can breathe on them.
Well, yeah. Well, it's nice to have them out where people can see them. The truth is, after one of those big movies or Farscape, stuff like that, we can fill a warehouse with all the creatures and the set pieces that you'd think, oh, they're all fantastic. You should keep them forever. But the truth is, you know, we have to get rid of a lot of stuff that you'd think, oh, don't, you can't get rid of that. But at a certain, after the company's been around 50 years, it's amazing how much stuff there is. So it's really great when we can put stuff
all right,
where
so
people
I'll
can
have
see
a,
it.
I'll take a Skeksis and I'll take a Rolf.
No, I know, but that's the problem. We can't really give it away.
Oh,
I mean,
right.
What happened was we gave away.
Can I have a gobo? Uncle Charlie Matt. I was going to start listing off things that I might be able to have.
But we've had weird things. Like at one point, somebody said, oh, you're throwing away all this stuff. We're doing Farscape down in Australia. Oh, you're throwing away all this cool stuff. Do you mind if I take it? I was like, ah, all right, take it. And then it shows up on eBay.
Oh,
well, then
yeah,
that's
yeah,
a,
yeah, yeah.
And then
that,
that's
that
a problem.
You want it to go. Well, that's the thing about collectibles is that you. It's why it's hard for me to. I don't like to throw things away, but I know that if I can give something to someone who will value it and not try to make a buck off it, then that to me is like, oh, well, that's where that thing belongs. It belongs with. It belongs in a museum. It belongs with people who will take care of it and treasure it.
And actually, though, talking about museums, we did recently. It was my mother really was pushing hard for it and figured it all out really before she died. And she died a year ago. And but now a lot of the original Muppets are at Smithsonian, and that was something that she really spearheaded. The original Kermit's at Smithsonian, the originals, all the Sam and Friends puppets, which was the first show that they were doing when my dad was 19. Are at the Smithsonian, as well as Ernie and Bert, a few others, and then a big substantial collection of puppets will be at the Atlanta Puppetry Center. Center for Puppetry Arts, thank you. The Atlanta Center for Puppetry Arts, and they're working on their facility, so you can't really view a lot of it right now. And then the Museum of Moving Image in New York, in Queens, has a lot of the collection of puppets as well. So she recognized this stuff is going to, if it just stays in storage, that's not right. So she really wanted to make sure things ended up in good places. And she, I'm really happy with that now. And
how did they survive? Like, because I saw at the Lucas Archives, I saw what I think was the original Yoda.
Yeah,
and he was not looking too good. Yeah. It was just falling. It was like,
well, it's the like puppets.
Mickey
the
Rooney. that didn't end up well. This poor little puppet was just like, you know.
Well,
shredded.
Dust. They go to. The puppets last a long time. The ones that are made of fabric and ping pong balls and stuff like that. The only thing that gets really old on a Muppet is certain types of rubber cement get brittle. And that can be a problem. But that's relatively easy to repair. The what we call the realistic puppets, the creatures for Dark Crystal mm-hmm. and Labyrinth and all that, the skins on those are molded foam latex. And in order to, you inject the liquid foam into the mold, and then it sets into this lovely flexible foam that's like skin, and then you can paint it, and that's the foam latex skins that we started doing at Dark Crystal. The problem is the chemical that you need to put in the foam latex to make it set when it's in the mold also is going to eventually disintegrate the foam.
Sure.
So you have to rinse it. You rinse it as well as you can, and then you dry it out and you paint it. But depending on how well you rinsed it, the foam skin is going to last anywhere from 15 years to 25 years. But literally, one day you can open up the box and there's a creature, and then a month later you can open up the box and there's dust.
Oh.
Because it literally disintegrates from the inside out. So the last thing to disintegrate is the painted finish. And so the skin is... just come apart, unfortunately.
So it's so natural.
It's kind of poetic.
It is.
Well, it kind of is. It's like the foam latex, those kind of more realistic puppets actually have a lifespan.
that's kind of cool. This is sort of like cherish these while you can kind of a thing. I mean, I the strangest thing for me was the first time that I ever worked with any of the Henson puppets was when we did the Ben Folds video. I'd never actually worked with any of them, and we produced the Ben Folds video, and then, you know, it's when you see them, just when you see the puppets on the, you know, just like waiting to be activated, they just look like puppets. But the second the hands go in, they come to life, it's the strangest. I've never, I mean, I meet famous people sometimes, Brian, but there's no experience to me like the first time that Fraggle looked at me, or the first time like Swedish Chef, you know, we shot something like Swedish Chef, or the first time they look at you and you're just like, yeah, it just hits you on this insane level. Are you immune to that at this point, or does it still have an effect?
Well, it's been what I always grew up with. It was always what my dad was doing. I have a completely different relationship with puppetry than probably most people do.
I would imagine.
Because to me, it was, my dad was a very hardworking guy, and he was always clearly a very hardworking guy, as far back as I remember. So it was important. You know, the puppets were important with my dad. And to me, as a kid, I didn't have a sort of light feeling about the puppets. To me, they were important, and it was cool and interesting and hard work, and it required rehearsing through the night. My father would rehearse for, you know, all night long and not go to bed, and then get in the car and then go to the studio and to shoot something. And so I had I have a lot of respect for it. And to me, the ability of a puppeteer to put a puppet on and have it instantaneously come to life as a thinking being, because that's kind of the big thing. It's not when the way I would say, you know, you're looking at a good puppeteer versus you know you're not looking at such a good puppeteer, is a puppeteer will make a puppet move, and that can be entertaining. A good puppeteer puts the puppet on, and the instant they've got their hand in there and they're settled, the puppet's thinking, and you look at it and you know what the puppet's thinking, and that I think is impressive and impactful even to me. But it's like the art form. That's like, okay, you're in the, then you've done it. And I've trained a lot, so many puppeteers over the years, that that's what I'm waiting for. I'm waiting for them to get to that place.
How is that? I mean, how do you even start that process?
Well, it's, for us, it's an interesting process. And the training of puppeteers, what it was historically in the company was we would train in the technique of puppetry, which is how to work a puppet utilizing a monitor that shows you what the camera is seeing. Don't look at the puppet, look at the monitor so you see what the audience is seeing. And lip sync convincingly, move the mouth when the voice is, keep it in sync, make sure it's standing straight, that it has weight. When it's walking, make sure it steps like it has legs. All of these are like tricks to make it look more and more convincingly alive, or move convincingly alive. The thing about puppets is you want them to not look alive with the Muppets.
Right.
And puppets. When we do the creatures like Dark Crystal and Labyrinth, we wanted them to look like they were alive. But with the puppets, you don't want them to look alive. That's part of the magic, is it's clearly inanimate until it's performed, and then it's an illusion of life that is very entertaining and stimulating. But we would teach the puppeteers the technique of puppetry, the technique of puppetry, the technique of puppetry, and then we would hope that they had that instinct of performance that would make them good performers in terms of character development and acting ability. And we would train 20 puppeteers for everyone who could do it. And so we trained hundreds and hundreds of puppeteers to keep one out of 20. And nowadays what we do, which has been really successful for the last 6 or 7 years, and you've seen our Puppet Up show.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
So, well, Puppet Up is now the way we train puppeteers. So they're trained in, they train as puppeteers for the technique of puppetry, and they train in improv comedy.
Yeah.
Because improv comedy is all about developing a character very, very quickly. It's not the actor's technique of developing a character where you build the character from the ground up and it can take you 3 or 4 weeks to do it in a confident way. With improvising, you need to do a convincing level of character development almost instantaneously. And so we train in both improv and puppetry simultaneously, and that gives us a much higher hit ratio. We basically anybody who gets all the way through it is a good puppeteer. Anybody who makes it the company level in the Puppet Up troupe.
Now, Puppet Up was really interesting because the first time I saw it, it was years ago, and I saw it at the Avalon or whatever it's called. Is it still the Avalon?
I think it's still called the Avalon, one on Vine. Yeah,
the one on Vine, and it was unbelievable. Patrick Bristow was kind of directing it, and there were a bunch of great improvisers and. But it was also, the show was filthy, which was, I mean, I loved, but I was like, oh my God, I didn't know, you know, it was interesting to see this section of the kind of the Henson alternative brand, which was a little more adult humor. And so was there ever any resistance from people? Like, how dare you say the F-bomb on stage? Or because it was hilarious, but.
Well, the interesting thing is we didn't necessarily intend that. What had happened was, I think it was around 2003, 2004, I felt like the puppeteers had sort of tried to make the whole process a little bit too formulaic, and it was losing the spark that it used to have with my dad and Frank Oz and stuff like that. And the writers didn't know how to write in that spark, and the performers were only doing what the writers were writing, and it was just getting tough to make it funny anymore. So I wanted to just create a whole new tone of comedy for puppets, like my dad created the Muppet tone of comedy in the world of variety shows and Carol Burnett and those kind of shows. And then he created the Muppet Show. We needed something that was funny for now. And so I called Patrick Bristow and said, do you think you can? I think I've got to find this tone of comedy from the performers. I can't just keep looking to writers to come up with what's funny for puppets. It's got to happen in an organic way. So he said, geez, I don't know if that'll work because that's really weird. It was a really weird idea to do improv comedy with puppets. But we tried it, and it was working really, really well. And it wasn't necessarily going to be blue. It's just that was when you're improvising, it's just very funny to not censor yourself comedian and just let it come out. And we try to keep the show classy. We're not shock comedy.
No, not at all. Not at all. But also, you know, a lot of what happens in these types of improvised games are the audience kind of directs where they want it to go. Yeah. So, you know, that's why, like, oh, we need a location. Your balls. All right. You know, it's like, so they just, you know, they were feeding off, as good improvisers do, they were sort of feeding off the energy of the crowd. It was fantastic. I saw the show a bunch of times.
Yeah. No, it was, and you get really, the audience says, but then we try to make it classy.
Yeah.
Try to, but you have to try to do what the audience is asking you, but make it classy. I remember one was, the suggestion from the audience was, tell us a really bad location for a date. No, I'm not doing that one. I'm doing one that's even worse. So the suggestion we were asking for is tell us a really terrible location for a date. And the suggestion was a certain California governor's anus.
Sure, of course.
That was the suggestion.
That would be a really bad place for a date.
Yes, and so Patrick just said, okay, and over to the performers. And so lights up, and it's a guy and a girl puppet standing there, and the guy just goes, wow, who would have known there was a private bowling alley here? And that was it. It was like, huge applause, end the scene. It's like, you know, what else can you do? What else can you do? So, you know, we said, you know, but the show does get dirty. But the truth is, when I was a kid, and anybody who watched The Muppets being performed, Frank and my dad had really naughty sense of humor. You know, they and that's what they were doing. What we do with Puppet Up on stage in front of an audience is what my dad and Richard Hunt and Jerry Nelson and Frank Oz were doing before the actor called, the director called action, and after the director called cut, was precisely that. And in fact, that's the way the characters were developed. You know, Miss Piggy and Kermit's relationship is developed in an uncensored way, but then written in a censored way. Fozzie's insecurities are developed in an uncensored way, but then written in a censored way. And you can sense that. And, you know, when you watch the early Muppets, you can sense there's a naughtiness that's underneath it, a pretty sophisticated adult naughtiness in those characters that are presenting themselves. That's always why the Muppets felt kind of edgier, or edgy is a bad word, cooler and weirder and a little more irreverent than like Walt Disney characters.
Right.
You know, and there is a naughtiness that's underneath there. So you were asking, did the audience, had people push back and said, how could you do this? I certainly thought that that would happen. And when we went out and started doing shows, I thought, this is really dodgy for us to be doing this under the Jim Henson name. And oddly enough, I don't think I've ever had a review that got upset. And when we went to New York, because after we were playing with the show, developing the show for a couple years, I opened it off Broadway in New York and left it there for about 4 months to develop it into a bigger, more substantial show, which is the Puppet Up that now, when people go out and see Puppet Up, that's the show that they're seeing. And I remember saying to all the performers, look, now we're really doing, now we're no longer going to comedy festivals
right.
where people are expecting it to be dirty. Now we're going to be in a theater off Broadway and, you know, expect the reviews that say Jim Henson would be rolling in his grave. And not only did we not get that response, there was one critic, one Muppet critic, who loved my father so much and loved everything he did so much that anything we have done since, he hates. And I'm not going to say his name. I'm not going to say his name, but he's well known. Hates everything that I did. Vicious, ruthless in his opinions of my work. He comes and sees the show. I find out afterwards. Somebody afterwards said, you know, so-and-so was in the audience. I was like, oh, great, here we go. And now we'll get the review. And he said it was fantastic. Nothing really continued in the legacy of Jim Henson like this. You know,
that's so great.
Because it really does capture that original Henson energy that had to be censored in the 50s and 60s. Everything was censored. But if it was in a time where you didn't have to be censored, like today, this is kind of probably closer to the voice that you would have heard out of my dad.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is. It's something about these adorable little objects with adult themes and adult problems and adult issues that, you know, it's they were more human than even a lot of human characters that were on television in a weird sort of way, which you're allowed to do with animation and puppetry. There's a level of separation that I think people will allow, that if they were real people, they go, this is too real or it's too gritty. But if they're puppets, like, oh, it's sort of like South Park. Like, oh, no, but they're animated. So it's, you know, like so much, there's so many more things are acceptable because there's this layer of separation between reality. And
no, I think that's right. When you're an actor and you go on stage, the audience is still going to make all the assumptions that they do of people all the time. I mean, when you walk around and you see somebody on the street, your brain is doing making an enormous set of assumptions by analyzing that person. You're looking at the way they're dressed, the color of their skin, how clean they look, what their hairstyle is, and how they move, what their rhythm feels. And you're making all sorts of assumptions. And as soon as it's, and that already has put you in too intimate a relationship with them. So even with an actor on stage, you already have an intimacy. You've already made a ton of assumptions. And therefore, if they start to try to portray a bigoted character for comedic sake, but also to make a point, you may take offense at it because you're already in too intimate a relationship with them. Yep. Whereas with a puppet or an animated character, your brain can't do any of that stuff. So instead, even as an adult, you're going to watch a puppet or an animated character with your mind fully open, because you can't, your brain wasn't able to do all of that categorizing that it normally does. And because of that, then the puppet or the animated character can start doing all, can start doing material that goes into all sorts of places that you would find offensive if actors were doing it, because you are open, you can stay open to watch it run its course. Obviously, if you're offended, if you do a piece on prejudice or something like that, and it's a comedic sketch that could be offensive and stays offensive and then ends and it's still offensive, then you will have offended the audience.
Right, right.
But if you start in a place that could be offensive, but you resolve out, you watch that character get its comeuppance, you're able to tell the rest of the story. The audience really, really appreciates it, and in such a way that you can't really do with actors.
Because they're willing to see where it's going to go, or they'll go like, because they can't...
They're not already mad at that guy.
Right. Wait, I'm not done. I'm making, we're all on the same side. Please, stop throwing things. Oh, God. The first kind of inkling that I thought, you know, like, oh, I want to try to figure out if there's anything to do with the Henson Company. I mean, obviously, you know, my entire life. I mean, I can't think of anyone who is of my generation that's in comedy that was not influenced in some way by the Hensons. I mean, I just don't know. I don't know how that's even. I mean, I guess it's possible, but I can't really picture it. When I went and saw at the what is now CineFamily. There had been this. I guess maybe it was a weekly Henson retrospective of all these old films that I had never seen before. Of like the original pitch of the Muppet Show and these.
Oh, was this Craig's piece? Yeah, right, right. Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God! This stuff wasn't all over the YouTubes yet, so I just hadn't seen. But that one, it was the one pitch where they're basically describing what the Muppet Show could be. There's like a news reporter, and he calls out all the executives from that network and said, you know, and the people who greenlight this project will be hailed as geniuses, and they'll make all the money in the world
by selling kitchen cleaning fluids and things that you don't need, but you're going to buy because the show rates so well. No, it's absolutely.
It's so funny because there wasn't really a show. It was just this one puppet pitching what would happen if they greenlit the project. And how? And
no, it's a famous piece
that
my dad
did. And they didn't greenlight it.
No,
and they probably fucking hated themselves when it went over to England and then came back.
Yeah, yeah, it did. Yeah, it was. My father had a tough period there, and it's very interesting if you read the biography about him now. Even I was reading stuff that I didn't know. I always kind of thought the first show, because the first show that my father would talk about that he and my mom did was Sam and Friends, which was late night comedy. It's kind of cool and funky and adult. And then I'm reading the biography, and it's like, no, he was also doing like two kids shows during the day that he hated doing. So, but Sam and Friends he loved. Now, when he did Sesame Street, he only wanted to do it because he could do it with a more adult take on all of those characters, which of course is why everybody loved Sesame Street. They were like, wow, it works on two levels. It's because all those puppets are working on an adult level. It's not, they're, you know, Oscar the Grouch isn't going, oh dear, gosh darn it, you crazy thing. Yeah. You know, it's not kids entertainment for kids. It's all of those characters kind of have an adult underpinning to them that makes them entertaining to adults, and kids can also follow them, and it makes them more impactful for kids too. But at the time, he had always been on the Ed Sullivan Show. He was doing ad campaigns. He was a variety act, and he thought of his audience as adult. That's what he was doing. Well, adult, but family friendly.
Sure.
But adults, you know. And he didn't want to just be a children's entertainer. So he did Sesame Street. It was such a huge hit. And he was like, okay, that's great. Now I'm going to go get my primetime show on, because that's what he always really wanted. And he did two pilots of The Muppet Show, and they were both passed on by all three networks basically with the same message back to him, which is, Jim, you're that kid's guy. You're doing Sesame Street. It's, you know, you're great, but it doesn't make sense for an adult audience. And it really got him upset. And that's why he went on to Saturday Night Live. He was on the first season of Saturday Night Live, basically. And the first pilot of The Muppet Show, that was the response he got. So when he did the second pilot, he called it Sex and Violence with the Muppets. Because he was just trying to say, it's not a kid's show. Don't tell me. I would only buy this if I can put it on Saturday morning. You know? And it still didn't work. So then he went and did the first season of Saturday Night Live, knowing that the whole brief on Saturday Night Live was, we are going to push the censorship laws so hard, we might all end up in jail. I mean, that was really, everybody went into Saturday Night Live going, we're going to make the edgiest show that has ever been on television, and it's going to be a shocker.
Yeah.
and he was like, good, put me there. So he went and did the first season of Saturday Night Live, but then halfway through the season, that's when Lou Grade called him from London and said, look, I've seen your pilots, and they're great, so bring your people, bring your crazy people to London, and I'll make your Muppet show. And that's exactly what happened.
And then it sold back. Was it back in the syndication back to the United
States?
Well,
then Lou Grade wouldn't sell it back to the networks because they had passed on everything. Instead, he sold it region by region, which is why it was on at 7:30. It was on at 7:30 p.m., which is not the time that the main network is programming. It's every local territory. It was called primetime access. And every territory would buy the show that they played at 7:30. And he sold to all the territories in America. And they all basically went with Monday night or Sunday night. He was trying to get all of America to buy it and put it on the same night, which would have been a huge feat.
Yeah.
But he did get them. I think it was basically either on Monday night at 7:30 or Sunday night at 7:30.
Genius part about that is that that's the perfect time for, like, kids and their parents to be able to, oh, we're having dinner. We're sitting in front of the TV. It's the 70s. So it's like we watch television while we eat dinner. And it like that, and also thematically, what was happening in television at that time, you know, between SNL and Norman Lear, and then this whole like this kind of, you know, a much more realistic approach to character development on television is happening. It's like the timing of it couldn't have been better for this to break through. I mean, like it really was. He was in the right era to break through.
But certainly, all the networks rued the fact that they'd all passed on it twice.
Oh, man. That must have been such a sweet... Because I'm sure he ran into those people. They're like, Jim! Ah! We knew it. We knew this was going to be a big hit. No, you didn't. You passed on it. That's what television does.
And I think, wasn't it... Oh, now I'm going to get my facts a little wrong. I think Michael Eisner was at CBS at the time. So basically was instrumental in passing on the Muppet Show. And then had to watch as all of the owner-operated stations bought the Muppet Show for 7:30 p.m. and got the number one ratings success.
So what are you doing at this time? What are you doing when this is happening, while this is all happening?
Oh, I was real young. Let's see. Muppet Show started in 76, finished in 81. And I went to boarding school in 77. So what happened was my father... He went to London to do Muppet Show in the first season, and we would just go and visit, and here's the crazy thing, and I didn't like it, and looking back, it's because at 14 years old, I guess I was, I didn't understand the British sense of humor, which is very dry and appears that they're making fun of you. It seems like they're always teasing you and they're actually being affectionate. But at 14, I didn't get that at all. So I would go and visit my dad and in that first season, and you know, my dad would say, oh, so-and-so in the lighting department's daughter is the same age as you and she's having a party and she's invited you. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then I'd go to a party where all these other kids would make fun of me, I thought. And I would just get more and more like pissed off. And then I'd go home and I hate England. And so then the following year, my dad decided to move the family to London, and I said, I'm going to boarding school
rather than
do that. And so I went to boarding school, and then I would visit on the breaks, which is a lot when you're in boarding school. You're in school less because you're less days because you're in classes more hours. And so I spent a lot of time in London, but I was basically in boarding school. But the ironic part is The Muppet Show finished, and then they did Dark Crystal, and then I graduated from high school. I did half a year in college, fell in love with a woman in England who I met in Paris for one night, and had to convince her that she should have fallen in love with me in the 2 hours that I'd met her a year earlier. And I ended up being the one who moved to England, and then I married. I ended up marrying her. She was my first wife. We didn't stay. We'd stayed together for 12 years, though. So when I was the one who ended up living there after all the rest of the family moved back to America, and I was the one who said, I'm never going, and grew to love it, and figured out that they weren't actually making fun of me, that they were trying to bond with me. And I was rudely taking offense at everything they said.
And you were just not having any of it. When did you start the puppeteering yourself? Was that just a part of your genetic makeup?
You know, we were all, well, my dad was working all the time, so there was five of us, and we would visit, and it was always okay. I know that I've talked to other people who worked around my father who would say, you know, the weird thing was is that it was always made clear. We all had to live with the fact that Jim's kids might be anywhere. Because it didn't matter what he was doing. If he was going to have meetings, he might take three kids with him. One time he was very mad at me because he and Frank had a meeting with Jackie Onassis, and I was, you know, we were waiting in her office, and I sat way back in the corner, which of course was inappropriate. My dad shouldn't have been bringing me to meet while he's meeting with Jackie Onassis, but he did because he just brought kids with him all the time. And I just sat back in the corner, and they had their, you know, she came in, and then they stood up, and they shook her hand, and then they had the meeting. And afterwards, it was like the one time my father was so angry at me, and I said, what? And he said, you stand up. Jackie Onassis walks in the room, you stand up. And I was like, I'm sorry, Dad. I was trying to sit in the corner and not be noticed. And he was like, you stand up.
So now
I always stand up for women. And absolutely. I always stand up when women come into the room. And then I'm married to Mia Sara, and who I've also now been with a very long time, and we have kids, and we're very, very happy. She takes offense when men open a door for her and let her walk through ahead of them. And she's convinced they just want to look at her butt. She's convinced of it. So it's like she's hit me right on a raw spot, because it's like my dad would have gotten so mad.
You're
if I don't
allowed
open
though,
the door
but
for
you're
you.
Allowed. You're married. You're allowed. That's okay. Like,
just go through the door. Just go through the door. You can hold it open behind
I'm
you.
I'm shutting my eyes. I'm going to
open
shut
the door.
My eyes.
Go through. Hold you it behind through. You, I'm and I'll get it.
I'm shutting my eyes. I mean, yeah. I didn't. It wasn't. I found out that you lived in my neighborhood because I recognized her first. Because obviously Ferris Bueller was like that movie. I was the perfect age for that movie.
You would have.
I was the perfect age for Ferris Bueller.
You fell in love with my wife.
Absolutely. But I also fell in love with Ferris Bueller. And I also we've had this long-standing, I don't know if she would get a kick out of this, maybe not. She's probably tired of hearing about it. But we've had this long-standing theory on this show that Ferris Bueller is essentially Fight Club, and Ferris Bueller is a projection of Cameron Fry's psyche that he does not exist.
That's
so that
very
you,
funny.
If you go, if you and Mia would be the Helena Bonham Carter character. So if it's really the whole movie takes place essentially as
in Cameron's bedroom.
In Cameron's,
he's never left
in
the
Cameron's
bedroom.
Head.
He never left the bedroom.
Yeah, and he goes back. and you know, like when he goes back and he sees the guy at the restaurant, and he's like, "Oh, was someone just here saying to be Abe Froman? Yeah, that was you. What?" And then that's like all of the walls of his reality come crumbling down. So that's my theory about that movie.
I wonder. It's
really but I saw her in the neighborhood first, and I was like, oh my God, Mia Sara lives in the neighborhood. I'm like, oh, I think she's with Brian Henson. We're like, wow, really? And it was all around the same time that we started seeing Puppet Up, and you know,
and then we came up to San Francisco. That was all pretty. All within... Oh, no, San Francisco was a few years later.
You came up to Sketchfest a few years later,
okay.
Yeah. But we just started to have conversations with, you know, at the time, Janet and you and Nicole at the Henson Company of, you know, what could we do? Because we were just so enamored of everything. And we brought Neil Patrick Harris to the Puppet Up show because he's a huge Henson fan. And it just all kind of mashed
came together pretty quick there. Yeah. That was... Neil Patrick Harris' Dreams and Puppets. Those are some of the coolest pieces we
did. Oh, those were so great.
Yeah, and really good.
Now I'm seeing... every once in a while, Paul F. Tompkins will post an Instagram picture of this show that he's doing, and I see, like, oh, there's the hot dog character. Oh, there's the little kind of anteater character. Like, all the different characters are popping up now, but I recognize all of them.
Well... The way when we created Puppet Up, it was just organic. It all just sort of fell together because to start with, it was just a training workshop where I was just trying to find this voice of comedy, and that then I could let writers watch, and then writers could write better comedy for puppets, and then it just became a show, and it became a show in the weirdest way because we just said, well, let's put a show up for the company, and we'll invite friends and. Some of the friends were producers of the Aspen Comedy Festival, and then at the end of it, they said, well, bring your show up to the Aspen Comedy Festival. Well, it's not really a show. Well, bring whatever you just did up to the Aspen Comedy. That's sort of the way it happened. And the puppets we were using for the workshop were just all the puppets that didn't have jobs. So they were just all mixed together. So puppets from highly stylized artsy shows would be mixed with puppets of realistic animals, of puppets of people, and a weird mixture of oddball puppets that don't belong in the same production. And historically, you know, my dad was such a... He was a graphic designer, really. I mean, I think that's where he kind of thought his life was probably going to go. When he was in college, he thought, I'll hopefully, when I get past this puppet nonsense, I can finally design sets. <You know? laughs> And he would do, like, graphic ad campaigns and stuff like that. That's kind of what he... So, for him, the puppets were always very graphically careful, and they always worked well together. And the Puppet Up Show is puppets that really don't belong together. But it helped it... be adult comedy. It's kind of like South Park looks like bad animation. That makes it more adult.
Yeah.
You know, and even Simpsons, when it first came out, wasn't considered nice animation.
No, it was like, real
it's
dirty.
It's bad animation,
yeah.
And therefore it feels more adult. And the same thing sort of applied to puppets. So we called that group of puppets the miscreant puppets, the troublemakers, the miscreants. And the miscreants basically do... more adult-themed comedy. So that show that you're talking about is called No, You Shut Up. It's on this brand-new channel called Fusion, which some people can get, but if you have DirecTV, you can't get it yet. It's a new channel. But the miscreants are the guest panel of experts that Paul is talking to. And they talk about topical subjects, and they debate everything. You know, everything that other people are debating, they debate with puppets, and it's very, very funny.
So you have this cast of
miscreants.
Miscreants, for lack of a better words, like utility puppets. They can be anything.
Yeah, none of them have locked in personalities.
They don't have none of them have an identity. They can be one minute, right. They can be this thing, and next minute they can be this thing.
Yeah.
So what's the challenge or the difference in? Could you take one of the miscreant puppets and all of a sudden just make it? Well, just lock in a personality and be like, well, that's this character from now on. Or is that a different process between, you know, developing like a Kermit or a Red Fraggle or
you know what? The truth is character development happens in so many... It basically can be driven... A great vision for a character can come from a lot of different places. It can come from the designer... who designed the puppet, can have a very strong vision of what it looks like and what its personality is and everything, and puts it into the design. And right from the beginning, Fozzie Bear was like that. He was a design before he was anything, and it all worked very cleanly. It really started with the design, I feel. But then you'll have times when the writer has, you know, Jerry Jewell was the head writer for the Muppets. He would have an idea for a character, and he would write on the page, and it was so clear, and everybody could feel it, and that would be the character. And then the puppeteers often, Pepe the Prawn is Bill Beretta's aunt. It's his impersonation of his wife's aunt. And it was very funny, and he used to just do it himself, and he said, I got to put a puppet to this. And that's the way Pepe the Prawn came about. And so it can come from a performer, from the writer, from the designer. And then sometimes it just happens. And some of the best characters just happened that way. And And I can name, in a lot of ways, that's the way Miss Piggy started. Miss Piggy was kind of one of a bunch of pigs and kind of threw a wig on her. And Frank did her sometimes and Richard Hunt did her a little bit, but Frank had a better angle. And then, but it wasn't really working. And then Frank and Jim figured something out within the real, you know, Frank figured out that she's got a crush on Kermit and that she has a very high opinion of herself. And then it all started working. And so, but that was one where the right puppeteer picks up a puppet and magic happens. And those, to me, that's very much what all of the miscreants are. When you're watching Puppet Up, it's always puppeteers picking up a puppet and boom. It's just something happens. And we will take a miscreant and make it a star. I mean, we will. We do often go, okay, that's a great character. We're going to design something for it. And that'll now be what it is. It'll be that character and it will no longer be one of the miscreants. But, you know, and Frank described Miss Piggy wonderfully. What was it? She basically is a truck driver that believes she's Marilyn Monroe.
Which is where you do you get her turn every right, once in a while.
Turn out her. You know, yeah. You need someone to take care of the situation. Yeah, when she starts growling, the truck driver comes out.
And then the hair goes back in place, and it's a. Well, I remember because on an early episode of this podcast, we basically assembled a Muppet episode where we had, you know, a handful of the performers, and they all. Called in, and then we have just conducted interviews, and then we just sort of like weaved it all together. And some of the stuff that we didn't use was amazing, because it was sort of like what you were saying before about like, oh, it's just to the edge of what you know, it's a little dirty, but then you just shave a little bit of that off and then it becomes okay. Mm-hmm. But talking to Dave Gels about he was doing Gonzo, and I was like, so what is it that you like about a chicken, and he just goes, oh God, I don't know. I mean, you just, they were just look with their leg, like where it goes all the way up and just connects right to the end. It starts getting really creepy. And I'm thinking it's amazing. And then afterwards, the official Muppet folks were like, maybe don't put that part in there. Cause it was so like, it was so in detail right where the leg just connects to the underside. I mean, how could you not be in love with that? I mean, he was so true. It was so human, for lack of a better word. It was so true. And it totally made sense. I mean, it was like, oh yeah, this is the inside of Gonzo's head. This is what he really thinks about this thing.
Well, Gonzo is very twisted.
Yeah.
You know, he's got very deep-rooted perversions. Well, he has. His very first act was going on stage and eating tires.
Yes. And he also, because Paul Williams was on the podcast a couple months ago, and he was talking about, you know, Gonzo's this in the universe of the Muppets, he's this kind of fish out of water. You don't really know what he is, and he's, you know, you think maybe he's from somewhere else, and it's the whole like, I'm going to go back there someday and all that stuff, and so he's a character that I always identified somewhere between Fozzie and Gonzo, because, you know, Fozzie being a comedian and then Gonzo just being sort of this lovable outcast that you feel like, oh, you know, there's probably a dark side under there. There's probably some dark stuff under there.
No, it's the quintessential misfit.
Yeah, yeah, he really is. But so lovable, but at the same time, you're like, there's...
I'm not really anything. Oh, yeah, but he's very odd.
Did they,
and again, this is going back to when they're developing the relationship, it happens in an uncensored environment that then becomes censored. Like Piggy's attitude towards Gonzo is always quite grossed out by him.
Yeah.
And it's his perversions that gross her out.
She just knows that there's something about him that's not. She just doesn't want to be alone in the same room. It's just weird. It's just odd.
I don't want to be near your thoughts.
But just one more. No, shut up. I don't want to hear it. With a lot of these character developments, because obviously, so many of the characters, I guess, in any kind of puppet troupe, you can have a couple that have their own personalities, but then a lot of personalities sort of develop on how they complement every other character, I would imagine, right? I mean, like, there's not really... Gonzo doesn't work as well if he doesn't have that effect on Piggy or doesn't have this relationship to chickens or is not... It's like, where is he now? What is he? Oh, he's floating up there. Sure, why not? You know, like, he has to... His effect on the other characters, his relation to them, that informs a lot about who he is as well.
Sure. Gives you the opportunity to inform the audience. I mean, that's just good writing. You know, you, whenever you're writing and you have a core group of characters, you have to write into the dynamic that they are interdependent, that they are going to be forced together.
Yeah.
And it gives you an opportunity to reveal their characters in those moments. Yeah.
I mean, it's so much of the character, I've never been to the creature shops in New York, right? Your actual creature shop is in New York.
No, the creature shop is... There is a creature shop in New York. There is a creature shop here in Burbank. It's a little bit... The real roots of the creature shop was... The big creature shop was in London. And it was the one that was started... Not formally for Dark Crystal.
Right.
And then after Dark Crystal... It formally became the Creature Shop, and it was the London Creature Shop that got very big at one point, and was in Hampstead and Camden, and at times had 200 or 300 people working in it. That was our big Creature Shop, and at that time the New York shop was called the Muppet Workshop. So we had two shops, and specifically the Muppets were made in New York at the Muppet Workshop. The creatures, animatronics, and more visual effecty characters, creatures, were made in the creature shop in London. Then we opened up a creature shop in L.A. to service the L.A. industry without not needing to do it all the way from London. And that became the satellite shop for the London shop. And then when the problem with the London, the British industry in general, is it just has these awful peaks and troughs. And the industry goes completely dry for a number of years. And then it booms, and then it goes complete. And one of those dry spells, we had to close the London shop. And it was when the company was getting smaller over here, and it was getting a little unwieldy. So we closed that original creature shop and beefed up the L.A. shop. And that became the sole creature shop. And then when the managing of the Muppets moved over to Disney, and we were still doing puppets.
That
but
didn't
we
end up working
be,
out.
But
that
we weren't going to do Muppets. Then the puppet workshop was in New York. And then we thought, you know, we're just going to call them both creature shops. So the New York workshop is also now called a creature shop. But traditionally, that was the Muppet workshop that became the New York Creature Shop.
So what is the actual development of the puppet process, is that the basis for the sci-fi show?
No, the sci-fi show is creatures, specifically. It's Jim Henson's Creature Shop Challenge. And we tried to do a little... It's obvious when you're watching the show, but we really bifurcated the type of creatures, characters we were creating for Dark Crystal. That was the big experiment that my dad did. That was what he wanted to do. Muppets and hand puppetry in general is one kind of art form. It's the puppet is clearly inanimate. We were talking about this earlier. It's not an illusion of life. Kermit the Frog is not an illusion of life. He's clearly felt. His eyeballs are made of ping pong balls, and you can see all of that. And Fozzie is clearly fur fabric. He's fake as can be, and so is Kermit. And so, you know, Piggy, maybe a little less fake, but still pretty fake.
Well, it's all those...
And then you bring it to life through puppetry, and that's part of the fun, is bringing an inanimate object to life. Dark Crystal was the beginning of the creature side of character creation in the Henson Company, where visually the creature is meant to look alive. It is an illusion of life.
It's supposed to be autonomous and...
You just believe it's alive. I mean, we say to people, look, the easy way to remember is if you cut it and you think it should bleed, that's a creature. If you cut it and you think there's going to be stuffing in there, that's a puppet.
Or if it bleeds and it's someone's arm.
No, but basically, so it's a sort of it's a different thing. So the Creature Shop Challenge is it's the the designers in that are creature designers. They're not building puppets. Because that's a different art form where the puppet is deliberately inanimate until you bring it to life with a puppeteer. With the creatures, you're still going to bring them to life with a puppeteer. But what you're trying to design is something that actually looks like it is alive.
Yeah.
It has history. If it's an old creature, you can see that it's old. You can see it from the way it looks and the way it's designed and the way it's finished. So the Creature Shop Challenge is specifically the designers and builders of creatures. And they have animatronics in them. They have extra movement and stuff like that. So it's more, the Creature Shop Challenge is not in the Muppet Miscreant Puppets area of our company. It's in the creature fantasy side of our company, Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, Farscape, Dinosaurs, Storyteller, those kind of creatures is what the Creature Shop Challenge is. And so the contestants is a bad word I don't like, but the creature designers who are participating in that, that's what they're doing. They're designing and building creatures in a very short time. And then for a screen test, a film test, and in every episode, they're given a brief by me to build a specific creature with specific criteria. And then at the end of the episode, there is a screen test where those creatures have to come to life in front of a camera and be screen tested. And then every episode, one designer is eliminated and one designer wins. And the one that wins gets a job in the Creature Shop.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So that you've already shot the show and it's about, when does it air?
It's airing. What do you mean?
Is it airing now?
We're three episodes in.
Oh, Jesus. I don't get to watch television anymore.
Actually, if you TiVo, the cool thing is, well, part of it is, I did all this publicity. It's Sci-Fi at 10 o'clock on Tuesdays, and then in my house, it's on 9 o'clock, because DirecTV is on a different end.
Yeah, you get that's it the at thing, 7. There's no...
So it's all like, these days, it's like, you can't even tell somebody what time something's
on. Our show's
on.
Called At Midnight on Comedy Central, but in the Midwest, it's at 11 p.m. because there's central time.
Yeah.
So then on top of the time zone, it's like, well, I don't know when the carrier's going to put this on. It's like, well, if you get the East Coast feed, it's on at 9. But if you get the West Coast feed, it's on at this...
It's best just to say the day.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
On Tuesdays.
Look on your guide, on your whatever your cable now, or
so the Creature Shop Channel, it's on Tuesdays on Sci-Fi. And actually, they're doing, like, every Tuesday, at some point, they'll repeat the episodes that lead up to it, sometimes very early in the morning, maybe in the middle of the night, so that if you do TiVo, Jim Henson's Creature Shop Challenge, for next Tuesday, your TiVo will pick up all the episodes, so that you will have all four.
Oh, good.
By next Tuesday. Next Tuesday will be the fourth episode of 8. The first season is 8 episodes, so we're almost halfway through.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, it's kind of fun to It gives you the opportunity to identify people that you wouldn't have known otherwise. It's always fun to find a new, oh, wow, this person was just hiding out in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And they're great. And they deserve Oscars and stuff like that. And they'll never win them. And that's part of what, early on, people have said to me, well, you should do a reality show. And I've always thought, well, there's only a couple we can do where you have these extraordinarily talented people that you don't see. One are the ones who are underneath the puppets.
Yeah.
And the other ones, to me, that are the most interesting and complex are the designer builders of the creatures. And so this is the show that points a light at those talents. And they're extraordinary. And they'll never win an Academy Award. They do occasionally, but they do for the wrong reasons. Like the creature designer may have also done a prosthetic makeup, and therefore they're in the makeup category with the makeup artist, and they win an Academy Award, one of the creatures is actually goes all the way over your body and kind of qualifies as a costume, and therefore they can win an Academy Award for costuming. But it's always they're winning awards by forcing them into categories they don't belong. But they really are the most extraordinary artists, and people don't know about them, and they just see the creatures on screen. They don't know what went on before, and so it's always been an exciting place to point the spotlight at, and I think I couldn't be happier with the show.
Well, especially now, because my girlfriend's dad is a special effects guy, and he's been a special effects guy for decades, and his big thing now is like, meh. Now I just kind of stand behind people at computers and just point at shit. Like, I don't, you know, like he, as it was a guy who had to make stuff with his hands, the idea of practical effects, practical
creatures. It all has to happen in front of this camera.
Strangely, I really prefer practical effects to, I'm like, I'm more impressed by practical effects, particularly now, you know, and I have no, like, if I see a Twilight movie commercial, I'm like, they could have spent a little bit more money to make that fucking wolf look like it had weight. You know, like, I get really upset about that. And I just think, like, I would love to see more practical creatures or practical effects in film.
Well, I think what we'll see is more of a mix. There's clearly some very cool strengths to practical creatures. And to me, we always say in our company, we protect the performance of the characters so that we are a performance-based company as opposed to an animation-based company or something like that. And when you really put a creature in an environment, particularly if it's speaking, you're protecting the potential for spontaneity in a scene. As soon as you're doing CGI, the good ones can create the illusion of spontaneity, but there never actually was spontaneity. Sure. There was never an opportunity for something to happen that you didn't expect.
Right.
And really, great entertainment is having things happen that you hope will happen, but not the way you expected them to happen. And in real life, that's what happens, and that's what's intriguing and fun. And when you're in a performance art form, things will happen in the way that you can have put four performers together, and no matter how in sync they are, things will happen in a way that none of the four of them expected, and that's part of what's fun. And the great thing about doing creatures practically is you are protecting that spontaneity. You do get that it really happened. There really was chemistry in the moment. It was real, and it was captured by the camera. And as soon as you do it all in CGI, you have to impersonate spontaneity. But there's also real weaknesses, obviously, with animatronics. It's hard to make them speak as convincingly because you have to get all that mouth working perfectly in front of the camera. It's hard to make them have the expressions quite with the same level of subtlety because, again, all those motors have to work in front of camera. Hard to get them to walk around. Hard, you know, there's a lot of things that are hard to do with the practical ones. I think what we'll see, I thought what Spike Jones did with us with Where the Wild Things Are was really spot on good idea, which was do the wild things as animatronics and then enhance the hell out of them with CGI so that you get the spontaneity of we captured it in the moment in front of a camera and we've edited it, but then we made everything perfect in the computer so that all the expressions and the speaking and all that we were able to perfect with CGI. But the effect of Where the Wild Things Are is you really do feel like they were really there because they really were there.
Yeah. You know? So you do the walk arounds for the macro effects, and then the micro stuff is all just
when you need those expressions to be incredibly subtle and the lip sync to be perfect because you're in a close up, then absolutely use the computer. Use the CGI.
Is it true that this is probably maybe Jonah Ray told me this. Is it true that your dad did not want to subtitle anything in Dark Crystal and just have like the Skeksis just like rah, 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 you know, like rah.
No, it wasn't gosh, now I don't remember. True? Was there subtitling? No, it was not in English and it was not subtitled. It was not subtitled.
Didn't they subtitle the movie?
No. I mean, like, no. No. Yes, I'll tell the story. I was there. No, it was the only characters. Gelfling, the language of Gelfling, was meant to be English.
Yeah.
So anybody talking to a Gelfling who could speak Gelfling would be speaking English. So Jen and Kara spoke English because they're Gelflings. Some of the pod people could speak in Gelfling. Mm-hmm. Because they'd learn it, so they would speak English occasionally. Augra could speak Gelfling because she was so ancient and wise and could speak every language, so she could speak Gelfling, but nobody else could. Oh, and I think the mystic at the beginning that was Jen's master was speaking English to Jen because he was speaking Gelfling for his benefit. Right. But everything else was in made-up languages.
The Skeksis weren't... No, they didn't subtitle, but they did speak some English. Like
And then what happened was he tested the movie in front of the Universal executives, and they just hated the fact that they were speaking in languages they didn't understand. So, no, my dad had to go back and dub in English for everything.
That's
so
what that's...
Everyone was speaking English in the end, but it was not intended to be that way.
Do you think, did you sense that, would he have just gone in a more and more experimental direction? I mean, it feels like if you're trying to push the boundaries of like, oh, I want to try to, you know, develop new territory and break new ground, does it just seem like that he would have just tried to do more and more experimental things forever? Or do you feel like he would have come back around and been like, oh, I like doing kids stuff, maybe?
I don't think he ever particularly liked doing kids stuff, if you know what I mean.
I mean,
not that he appreciated kids stuff, and he loved Sesame Street, but he didn't want to keep doing kids stuff. And Fraggle Rock he developed as a kids show, knowing it's a kids show, but... And as active as he wasn't very active in Fraggle Rock. I mean, he'd come in direct episodes, and he loved it, and he appreciated it. But really, it was Jerry Jewell and Michael Frith who were really making
Fraggle
Rock.
Yeah, because I know you'd said that he didn't like doing kids stuff, but I wonder, sometimes when people get older, they're like, you know, maybe I'll just go back and do stuff for the kids.
No, I don't think so. I think he was going to keep doing Muppets, but he had done 3 Muppet movies. When he did Labyrinth, that was after the 3rd Muppet movie, which was after Dark Crystal. You know, he wouldn't so much experiment and then drop something. He would do it until he thought he was doing it the best he could, and then he would drop it. Like Muppet Show, he canceled after 5 seasons. Everybody thought he was insane because it was the most popular show in the world, and then just at the end Dallas got ahead. Which is insane. It's like, oh, I feel really good about the world. The Muppet Show's the number one show in the world. Now Dallas is. Now I don't feel so good about the world anymore. but he canceled it right at the top of its success. But because he thought now it was as good as it was going to be. He thought, okay, the Muppet Show is as good as it. That's good. That's great. That's what I wanted it to be. I don't want to keep making it. I don't know if I can do better. So that's when he stopped making The Muppet Show. And I think when he did Dark Crystal, he felt like I want to go in this direction. So when he made Labyrinth, he was trying to address some of the criticism of Dark Crystal. Dark Crystal was very somber and dramatic, and there were humorous elements in it, as there is in any life experience, but it wasn't as funny as the audience would want it to be. So when he went back to do Labyrinth, he was basically responding to 2 criticisms. One was, we're not sure we want to see a movie that's all creatures. So he put in David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly into Labyrinth, and he had a couple people. So he was a little bit back to the dynamic of Muppet Show, but in a creature fantasy reality. And then he brought in Terry Jones to write the script so that it would be more overtly humorous, and so that was Labyrinth. And I think he would have kept going, but then after Labyrinth he went and did the 3D Muppet movie for the Disney theme park, so he wasn't stopping with the Muppets, but you know, I think he was really glad to do that 3D movie, because if you've seen Muppet Vision 3D at Disney, it's not that he just did another Muppet movie, short Muppet movie, and did it with 3D cameras. It was that he did a whole thing that was just about 3D. The Muppets doing 3D. And you know, and it seemed fun and fresh for him. But, yeah, I think he was always very experimental. If you go to film school, many film schools will carry his film Timepiece. And, yeah, Timepiece is considered... I don't know, now I can't remember because I didn't go to film school, but I remember people basically saying they felt it has several techniques in it, filmic techniques that were the first, that he was the first doing it in avant-garde filmmaking. He was the first to do edits that were seemingly completely unrelated images coming in a fast series to create one coherent thought. And if you see Timepiece, it's a very experimental piece, really successful, and he stars, and it's a lovely, it's basically a study and a meditation on the trials and tribulations of time, and it's a great piece, and it won at the time a regional Academy Award. It used to be that there weren't just the Oscars in California.
What?
They were all over the country. And I don't even think he won. I think it was nominated, but because it was so unusual for its time, but it is considered the first piece that then started a whole American style of avant-garde filmmaking. And, you know, he was a very progressive visualist. I mean, there was always interesting stuff. I don't think he would ever know what he was going to do next because he was almost more waiting for that thing that sparked him.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, it seems like he was an artist in the sense of the purest sense of, like, he just loved the art of it and the craft of it. And I feel like, you know, the older you get and the better you get at something, you know, how do you keep challenging yourself or how do you keep finding new roads to go down?
Well,
you know,
I think
especially if you've created a lot of them.
Well, I think he just always was trying to, he always was trying to do something different. He was always trying to avoid being derivative of other people's work or even his own. So after he did 3 Muppet movies, you know, now there's been 8 Muppet movies made, but he only made 3 of them. And, you know, for him, he was always looking to do something different. He always wanted to do something different. Again, I come back to who else would have canceled the Muppet Show after 5 years other than somebody who was very confident in the idea of, no, what I like to do is something different. That's what he likes to do.
But that's a really important choice to make, is knowing, like, I've given this thing everything that I have to give and I want to go start somewhere else. Like, you can't... It's so important to... I mean, no matter how... The success part isn't really the goal. And like, all the material success isn't really the goal. It's how do you keep getting excited about something and how do you keep telling stories that you're excited about? And if you're not excited about something anymore, it doesn't matter if someone's like, here's $1 billion. Great. I have $1 billion that I don't know what to do with that. I'm bored. Like, I still need to be creatively, you know, I still need to be creatively challenged in some way.
I have a very good friend who's a big writer, executive producer, and I won't say his name, but I love spending time with him because he's very successful and in very high demand, and he doesn't give a darn about money. He just doesn't. So, and he has no problem saying to studio heads and network heads, you cannot convince me with your showers of gold because it means nothing to me.
Well, that, you know what? That's a very... That is an instantly empowering position to have in this town, which is so... driven by financial leverage. I mean, if you don't...
Well, because people use it they use it as a way of ranking you.
Sure.
You know, how much are you being paid is how successful you are, which is really ridiculous.
And controlling you, too.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
well, if you don't get this, you're not going to get this. But if you go, well, I don't want that, and they're like, oh, I don't know then. I don't know what to hold over your head. Like, well, you can't, because I don't care. I think that's a great place to be. I think that's real success. Whether or not you're even in a financial place to do that or not, if you can say, like, yeah, I don't care, then, you know, then I think, and you do what you want to do, I think that's really important. What is it that, what stuff do you still want to do, or where, you know, where's your heart these days?
I don't know. I sort of shift around. I've been very lucky that I get to bounce around like nobody can. I get to, you know, do kids programming when that makes sense. I really enjoy doing the digital puppetry, trying to take that to that whole process of in real time performing digital 3D CGI characters, but doing it in real time with camera operators, working virtual cameras with performers, performing animated characters, and doing basically creating a fully animated product with a fully live action performance process. That was super exciting to me, and getting to where we made Sid the Science Kid that went on PBS, that's really great. And I still want to do more with that. I want to take that technique to feature film level. I would like to slow down. It's really impressive. We were making 2 half-hour episodes of animation a week.
Oh, wow.
Who else can say that? It then goes through a post-production process that makes it take a little longer, but the production process, a week for 2 episodes. And that's really impressive. It's like shooting live action, and I would like to take that approach to feature films and do a feature film with digital puppetry and show what that's capable of. That I would find very engrossing. But I get to jump around. There was a series of 1-hour movies for TNT a few years back that were Stephen King short stories, and the group of movies were called Nightmares and Dreamscapes for TNT, and a friend of mine was the executive producer, Bill Haber, And it wasn't a Henson Company production, but he sent me this script and said, I have this fantastic script, but it's impossible, and I don't know how to make it in a television schedule and budget. And that, for me, that's the surefire hook. When somebody says, this thing feels impossible, I don't know how to make it, that's the one that I really like. I like to try to do something that has kind of never been done and people don't know how to do it, where you literally have to invent the techniques for the product. And that was the episode I made. They were one-hour movies. It was called Battleground. And in the end, it was an adaptation of a seven-page Stephen King short story to a one-hour movie, and had no dialogue. And we put William Hurt in the lead, which was right there. It was like, okay, this is ridiculous. We have a one-hour movie with no dialogue, and we're casting the guy with probably one of the top three dramatic voices in the country.
I'm not saying anything.
Never going to speak.
Not a word.
Not a word.
No, not John Hurt. William Hurt.
Oh, I'm sorry, William Hurt.
but Bill Hurt.
I'm not saying anything. Not a word. Sorry, I was just trying to.
Yeah, no, that was pretty good.
No, I was.
But what came out was, you know, it was a really extraordinary piece. But it's horror. It was, for me, it was like, oh, when do I get to do horror? It was suspense horror. It's like he's a hitman and he goes and he kills the owner of a toy factory, and then he goes home and a box of toy soldiers show up, and then they come to life and they hunt him down in his apartment.
Oh, that
and kill
sounds
him.
Awesome.
Oh, it was a lot of fun to make, and TNT liked it. So my first cut was long. And I said, I've got a long cut. It's 58 minutes. And it's meant to be 44. And they came in, they saw it, and they just said, oh, we love it. We'll air it without commercials. And I was like, you guys are the most fantastic. You're the most fantastic people in the world. In television, when would you have a television? First of all, when would you have a network say you're allowed to make a one-hour movie with no dialogue? And then after they spend all that money, they go, we're going to air it without selling commercials. It just doesn't happen. They also had me. I had to also do a 44-minute cut, but for them to sell around the world. But they aired it on TNT with no commercials. That's really cool.
Fun. Yeah. Was there anything that your dad was ever up against that he really just wanted to do, but just the technology wasn't there yet?
Oh, sure. And I can't even really if he was, let's see, what are some of the things he would have done? He would have done like the large dinosaur shows and stuff like that are on stage, like the great How to Train Your Dragon live show. That kind of thing would have been great because he was very interested in doing theatrical spectaculars, but there wasn't technology that was around that would enable him to do it as spectacularly as he would have wanted.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I think we would have seen if he had lived is you probably would have seen the most amazing theater show where it would have been character driven with, you know, the sides of the stage literally that, you know, the breaking off from the stage and walking out into the theater. And he would have done something on a scale that nobody has ever thought would be possible because while he was still alive, there weren't the techniques to drive those big characters and creatures.
I just got chills. I just got chills hearing about like pieces of a stage breaking off and coming to life. Like, because that kind of immersive, it hadn't occurred to me. I mean, I'm an idiot because, of course, puppetry evolved from a live experience. And so, but so much of what we see is like, oh, it's on television or it's in film. But of course he would have wanted to go back to the theater and blow up on a massive scale, you know, what was a much more intimate art form. Ah, that had been such an amazing idea.
Yeah. And who knows what else he would have done. I do know when I was a kid and it was just sitting in our playroom, literally, which is kind of scary, but he was also very into nightclubs. The idea of them. I guess I was so little, but he wanted to. He had this idea for a nightclub that was like being inside an amoeba, and with the floor was polarized shapes, and he had designed this floor with these polarized panels so that it was all changing shape and moving like way. And 20 years later, people did start doing stuff like that. But for a long time, I can't remember what he called it, Celia or something. He had this idea of doing, you know, a nightclub, an evening nightclub where the whole room was alive and living. And
oh, that's really cool.
And he had it designed in miniature. And he couldn't get anybody to get behind.
I thought you were going to say, so we turned the playroom into this weird puppet nightclub.
No, I think unfortunately his beautiful model, I think, eventually came home with G.I. Joes on it. No, honestly, it's awful, some of the stuff that came home when my dad was like done with it. I remember that from, I guess it was from Sam and Friends, somebody said, oh, Chicken Liver, what a fantastic, it was one name of one of the characters, one of the puppets was named Chicken Liver. That was such a fantastic puppet. I wish I knew what happened to that. And I go, yeah. I remember my brother and I playing with that in the sandbox, outside in the rain. That's Chicken Liver's gone.
Way gone. So puppets were also for playing. They weren't just for work.
Oh, not often. I mean, the puppets didn't come home much, but if my dad was genuinely just done with something, it would end up at home.
But did you get separate, like, non-Henson? Did he make puppets for you? Did you get non-Henson puppets? Like, these are the puppets you can play with. Do not touch these puppets.
Well, if the do not touch these puppets would be at the studio.
Oh, gotcha.
They wouldn't have come home at all.
In fact, he
seldom ever worked at home. I only remember him when my little sister was born. I remember him sculpting a dog puppet. He was doing a puppet and he was sculpting the head at home. And honestly, that's the only time I saw him doing anything other than some script notes.
Sure.
At home. He went to the studio to do everything. If he brought home a puppet, he brought home and threw it in the sandbox because he was done with it and thought maybe we would like to play with it. And that didn't happen a lot. Now, he was very creative in the house, though. We would do crazy things. And it's still the house we grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut. The owners have carefully maintained the kitchen bathroom that when we were young, my dad had this idea that all the kids would do mosaics. We're all going to do mosaic walls. I guess, I don't know if he'd been to Europe recently. We're going to do Italian mosaics. So there's a bathroom in Greenwich, Connecticut, where each kid did a section of these little fancy mosaics. It's pretty impressive. And I went back recently and asked if I could come in and see the bathroom. And there it was, still there. And the kitchen was all the cabinets my dad made and painted all special. And they protected all of it. So he at home, he still did a lot of craftsmanship. And he built the most beautiful dollhouses for my sisters, my two older sisters. He built one for each of them that he built at home in the work. So he had a workshop at home, a pretty thorough one, but he used all that to make us toys. And I had a great rubber band gun, I remember, that he made. Fantastic. It was all wooden, beautifully crafted, but you would load it with rubber bands, and then the rubber band would hit, and it would held in the trigger, and anyway.
But I would see, like, giving that to a kid and then instantly regretting it. And when you get pelted in the face with rubber bands.
No, that's right. Well, actually, yeah, my dad was actually the type who really didn't appreciate getting shot in the face with a rubber band. In fact, it wouldn't have even occurred to me to ever do that. That would be definitely crossing the line.
Do you think this sort of do you think the kind of like the mad genius archetype, or they're too serious, you know, or is there ever any fun, or is it like no, I'm just super focused, I just have to do this thing?
Oh no, my dad was. Oh no, he was a prankster, and he and Don, Celine, and Frank loved to prank each other all the time. So he was very serious, and he often would work for 3 days in a row. Like for Sesame Street in the beginning, they did all the animated pieces as well as all the puppetry, all those number films and stuff.
Oh yeah,
he and Don and Frank, even though they were the puppet people, would over a weekend, and they'd compete with each other. Like, Don would do his number 12 film, and it would be fantastic. And then my dad would be like, oh, I'm going to do number 9. and Frank would be like, oh, I'm going to do number 3 and beat all of you. But they would work just, like, for 72 hours in a row. But they always were having fun. I remember one time I went in, and Don was in the work. Don was the head puppet builder. And then Frank was the performer, and they all did everything, but my dad was the boss, Don was really head of the puppets, Frank was really the main performer, and but I went in one time, and Don, who was this lovely, wonderful, eccentric guy, had a big handlebar mustache, and he always had hamsters, gerbils, the little ones are gerbils, and he had a gerbil cage with a slinky coming up out of it, and then the slinky would go across the room, And so his gerbils would be in the slinkies, bouncing all over the place. And they would hang by their tail above his head while he was working, and then drop off onto his head, because a slinky, they can get out.
Sure.
You know, they can get through the side of it. So I loved him for that. And his hobby that he would do on the weekend is take a 16-millimeter camera and go launch model rockets. This is back when there weren't really those testers model rockets much, but he would make these rockets that had like 8 or 10 of those tester engines, and then he put like a stick of dynamite in them. And he would go film it. And he'd fill it with like talcum powder with a half a stick of dynamite in the middle and put engines, and he'd film. He'd shoot these rockets into the air and blow them up. And I also thought he was really cool for that. But I walked in one time, and he was walking around the workshop, and he was like, "Shh, is your father coming?" And I said, "Yeah, he's down parking the car." He said, "Oh." And he's going all around the room with this long elastic. Remember the airplanes where you'd wind
it? Yeah,
yeah. Long strip of elastic. He's going all around the room, all around the room. And then he goes back to his table where he's building, and he stood, you know, where he builds puppets, he stood, and he put this fluffy thing under his shoe, and he said, "Okay, stay over there. And then my dad comes into the room, and my dad walks into the workshop, and Don just lifts up his foot, and this little creature that he'd made goes zipping all over the room because he stretched it and made my father just jump through his skin. And then my father was jumpy. He was actually a jumpy person, and they all loved nothing more than to make my dad jump. But they worked really hard, but they had a really good sense of humor, and they'd always shoot late, and any of them will tell you, and I saw it at 2 o'clock in the morning when you were meant to wrap at 7 p.m., but you're still shooting at 2 o'clock in the morning, you would often find on a Muppet shoot just everybody just laughing hysterically. You can't, because the last take went wrong, and then somebody did something, and it was so stupid that everybody's laughing, and you can't even work because you're just laughing so hard, and you're punch drunk because you've been awake so long. And honestly, I think that he worked very hard, but he loved to really play and enjoy it. He was a very funny guy.
And is there ever it feels like there should be a biopic or something, right? Or does that never? Do you think that?
There was the Muppet Man script that was the, what do they call it, the blacklist? It was a star on the blacklist a few years ago, and we've been trying to develop that, and it is a really cool idea. I don't know. The script that was written was actually a lot of fun, but my mother read it, and she said, and I said, "So, Mom, what do you think?" And she was like, "Oh, that's fantastic. I'm a star." Of course, none of this is true. I love it. They've made me a star. But actually, that's probably, some of it was true. It was based kind of sort of on truth, but it was an awful lot of invention. So we're trying to make it a little bit more realistic. But the Jim Henson biography that's out now, it's not authorized by us, but it is accurate. There's a lot of good stuff in that. I mean, when people want to learn about Jim Henson, you get his the biography that's out now is pretty doggone thorough.
Oh, okay, good. Well, I've adored working on that lot near you guys, and I was bummed when we had to move, but
you got too big.
Well, we expanded beyond because we were in this little bungalow.
Yeah, I know.
And then it was like, you know, everyone had an office, and then it was like two people to an office, and then like we took out it was like a little house, and so it was like now the dining room part had like four people in it, and then the back bedroom part had like five people in it. So we just had to. We got a little tight for the space, but I adored working there. It was so much fun to just drive there every day that I was there. I'm like, I can't believe I get to work here.
I know, it's a great lot.
So Jim Henson's Creature Challenge is on Sci-Fi Now Tuesdays at 10, you said.
Maybe. Not in my house, but that's what I've been telling everyone. They told me to tell everyone Tuesdays at 10, but not in my house. It's Tuesdays at 9 in my house. Yeah, sometime Tuesday evening. But if you haven't watched the first one, just TiVo it, because what will happen is next Tuesday, actually, they've already told me that on Sunday they're going to play them all again in the morning. And that's kind of what Sci-Fi does is, you know, as it's picking up momentum, they'll keep sort of doing marathons so that you can grab it either on your TiVo or you can catch up watching.
Let people catch up. Yeah. Excellent. Well, it's really, really, really great talking to you, and I hope that we can catch up off mic and, like, have lunch or something.
All right. I love your dog.
Oh, isn't that? She's the best.
She's gorgeous.
She's peeing on something somewhere. She doesn't. She's very Muppety. I mean, like, she's very fluffy. And
no, and the one blue eye.
She's got the one blue eye. And has no awareness that her teeth are essentially, like, tiny needles that, you know, when she's... If you're sitting on the couch and she'll start licking your foot or whatever, and then all of a sudden you're just like, God damn it! Like, she just doesn't know, you know? She just doesn't know. The relationship to her and Chloe's other dog, Diego, she's already bigger than. He's like a miniature deer. He's a little chihuahua. And she just, like, he'll just be sitting there and just the meaty part of his leg is open, like right where a dog's leg looks like a chicken leg. And she just like, just like right on that meaty part of his leg with those needle teeth. And it's, he hates the shit out of her. He was not pleased. It was sort of like your situation where he was a totally cool dog. And then and then when he realized, like, so she's going to occupy this space. Then it was like, I've never seen him get vicious, but he just... That's how they establish their dominance.
Yep. Well, it was my pleasure to come. I've had a fun time.
Yeah, good, man. Really good
to
see you.
We'll catch up.
Please, I'd love to. Enjoy your burrito, everyone. The end. Katie.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Carbonite.com. Carbonite is online backup made easy. Plans start at just $59.99 a year. Start your free trial today at Carbonite.com. Use the offer code Nerdist to get 2 bonus months with purchase.
For more than 2 centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.